Ah, quiet descends.
We got more noise going in.
It's not nearly as bad as the air conditioner. General background questions first, and then Doris will probably ask you some specific questions about music.
Mm-hmm. Can Carlos participate on an interview?
Yeah, sure. In fact, we might want to get you to sit next to each other then.
Come on.
Because that mic is pretty much unidirectional, and otherwise we won't pick up what you say at all.
Carlos, you want to move around?
No.
Bring your chair.
Between and drink a chair.
Then I need another informant sheet.
Carlos handles the agency.
Uh-huh.
Department.
I see.
Of us, the CNC Music Associates.
I see. And you do
that? And I just deal with the records.
Okay.
We both manage the groups.
Okay.
We consult each other as far as managing the groups. But he handles all the bookings, the nightclubs.
Right. All the
jobs and everything.
Okay. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, when did you come over to the States?
1960.
And why did you come over?
Well, I left Cuba because of political reasons,
mm-hmm.
and I was 18 then when I left.
Did you have trouble getting out of the country?
I had false papers. I had issued false papers and all that, and that's why I left. I went to Colombia in South America. My papers were showing that I was going to be a priest. I was going to a seminary. In Colombia, and Castro at that time wanted to get rid of all the everything that smelled Catholic and everything, so I left. And from Colombia I spent 6 months over there, and I came to the United States as a refugee. I had the regular visa, and then after my visa expired, then I just went to immigration and I said, I'm here and I'm not gonna go anywhere. So then they issued my papers as a refugee.
Were you alone?
I was alone then, yeah.
Yeah, so you had to pretty much leave all your family and friends.
I left my mother and father and brother, everybody. I left them behind. Then my brother left about 3 or 4 years later when they started the flights, mm-hmm. the regular flights, freedom flights. Then he left.
Yeah.
He came to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents left about a couple of years later than that.
Yeah.
So eventually the whole family got reunited again here.
Well, when you first came to the States, did you come to Miami?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I came to Miami first. Actually, when I came to Miami, I was supposed to keep... I had a scholarship in Belgium that never turned up. I don't know why. Through the Catholic, church.
Mm-hmm.
I was supposed to go to Belgium and study some... I was involved with the Catholic youth associations in Cuba, student movements and all that, to promote the democratic, Catholic things, in school and all that. And I was supposed to go to Belgium to study some more of that, thinking that Castro was going to be on for 2 or 3 years and then we would come back all charged up with new input from other countries and then, keep working at it. But that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed here and I became a musician then. And I started traveling. I went to New York then for about 5 years. I lived in New York and traveled with a very popular name band.
Who's that?
And that's Julio Gutierrez. He was a director of Channel 4 in Havana for many years, and he had, he was like one of the big names in Cuba. And I used to play drums for him and sing. And then after that, I quit his band to form my own trio, which started out as a trio, and turned into this The Judge's Nephews, which was one of the most popular bands here in Miami for many, for many years. And to be brief about it, from here, I started discovering new talent in town here, and I started recording and producing new talent and I sort of like went away from performing and having my own band, went into producing and recording new people. That's how I decided in 1977 I decided not to perform anymore. Mm-hmm. I dissolved the Judge's Nephews and I went directly into the record business and producing and everything. Mm-hmm. And last year, right, when I met you, Carlos was doing the same thing but on the you know, handling bands and booking bands in town. Mm-hmm. So we decided to team up. So now the bands that I produce and I, you know, record, we manage, and Carlos takes care of their jobs, you know, make sure that they're working. Mm-hmm. And between the promotion with the records that we do and the promotion with the management and the agency booking those bands exclusively, we have a pretty good team. Mm-hmm. Jackie takes care of the promotion, mm-hmm. all the newspapers and television, you know, everything that happens has to do with promotion, she does it.
Is there a pretty big market here in Miami for Latin music?
Yes, there is. We are, whatever market there is not, we are creating. Sometimes we have to create and look for opportunities or places that do not have Latin entertainment, but if we can see that maybe we express to them how they can turn it around. So where there is not opportunity, we try to make opportunity. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, mm-hmm. otherwise, you couldn't keep enough groups working.
Hey, Carlos, what's your last name?
Salasarte.
Salasarte. And tell me about your story. Where were you born?
I was born in Cuba. I came to the United States in 1956. And was here, went through school, started first grade through school here, and when I was about 13 years old, I started playing drums and beating on all the tables in the house and everything.
So you were a musician also?
Yes.
Did you play in a band before you got into what you're doing
now?
Yes,
I did. Mm. Up to 1979, I played in different bands. The last band I played in, the name of the band was Pearly Queen. We played throughout the area here. We played several states for a chain of nightclubs called Flanagan's Big Daddy's Lounges. Mm-hmm. And that's who traveled us everywhere. Took us all the way to San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. And until a gentleman by the name of Walter B. Walters told me, quote, "Get off the stage. Come and make real money." So he took me off the stage and taught me the business, the agency business. Mm-hmm. And then pushed me and got me started in that and guided me to get in Carlos's hair.
Well, this is, it's real interesting to me, the you know, your own personal stories too, because especially the show we're doing is on the effects of immigration and when cultures come in contact, the way that our culture becomes richer by having other cultures come mm-hmm. into it. We are a society of many different cultures.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so, it, you know, even yourselves, your own stories are very interesting because there was a big, as you know, influx at the time when you came of Cubans into the United States. And at that time, how do you think the big influx, do you think it had an effect upon our American culture at that time?
At the time that we came?
1960. Yeah, 1960? Right around that big push.
Well, locally in Miami, I think it had the biggest, you know, Miami was a very quiet city, you know, basically tourist, a lot of old people coming to rest, you know, it wasn't an exciting place, it was just a place to come to rest with a few shows, you know, but on a quiet basis. And the Latin American influence, especially the Cuban influence, turned it into a
you know, a pushing city, you know, the construction, this, you know, we started developing land and, you know, looking for more grounds for the people that was arriving to move in, and they started setting up their own business and trying to make it again, you know, and they came, especially the people that came from Cuba first. We've been having a constant, you know, immigration from Cuba, but from the beginning to now, the educational level has been decreasing. You know, the people that came first were the people that had business in Cuba, educated people, you know, that were successful in business, rich people, mm-hmm. and they came to Miami without a penny, but they had the know-how, they had the experience, you know. And if the person had a shoe factory in Cuba, they came to Miami, they bought all the materials, you know, their primary materials in Cuba from the United States, so they still had the connections. So they came here and they contacted their people again, and they say, okay, I'm going to open the same business here. And they borrow money, you know, and they went ahead and they started. And today they're millionaires again, you know. In 10, 20 years, they went back to what they were. They had the know-how. And to along with that, you know, their children, you know, kept that, you know, that perception of what, you know, these people were. Then after that, we started getting the lower class, you know. The class was kind of getting lower. People was searching for freedom, you know, coming over, but not that type of,
high class.
Not the high class, not as far as society I'm talking about, but as far as ambitious, as far as people with education, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we were getting less and less and less of that. We started getting then the working people, you know, we started getting the people that go into construction and the people that, you know, that's how we started building our community here. And now, the last shipment that we got, which Castro sent us, and that last shipment was, we got everything, but we got a lot of, you know, undesirable people that he wanted to get rid of, and he sent it over. So these people that we got last has kind of ruined the reputation of the first people that arrived, that have been working for 20 years, you know, and they have established names and businesses. Like now, if you take Miami and you scratch off every Cuban-owned business, we're left with very little, you know. We're majority, I would say, you know.
Well, do you think there's a lot of a lot of resentment, maybe, because it took so long to build up from nothing, and now the new immigration coming in has caused a lot of misunderstanding on the part of the public. Do you think there's some kind of divided community here because of the old, the landed Cubans and the new ones coming in, or are they trying to help assimilate them?
Well, I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
I think that, first of all, I wanted to say the minority of the people that came over were the undesirable ones, but they're all getting the same generalization.
Yeah, when you say from Mariel, which is the word that's been used, you know, it's the port that they left from Cuba, from that port, and it's called El Mariel. So if anybody that you say you came from El Mariel, then it's like, you know, you got a stamp on. Then I have to find out whether you are good or bad.
Yeah.
But if you say I'm from El Mariel, then you just watch out, you know.
Yeah,
those people were in jail in Cuba. Some of them were in jail because they stole a pound of meat, which is, you know, because they were hungry. But they're not really robbers, you know. The government doesn't, you know, they can't get the food, so they stole to eat. But that could be a person that in regular, like if they're here, they wouldn't go and rob to eat because they would rather work, you know. But we got others that would steal anyway, you know,
for the
But it's like Carlos said, it's a minority
right.
that has affected, you know,
right.
the rest of the people that are right.
But back when in the first real big wave, back in the late 50s, early 60s, what do you think the effects of Latin music were coming in here?
I don't think there was no effects yet.
No?
No, I think the effects started coming much later because, like, think about it. It took the people a while just to get established here.
Mm-hmm.
Even though back before the 60s, there was a wave of Latin music in New York.
Mm-hmm.
What years? With the Mambo and Cougar.
Yeah.
There was a wave then. I wouldn't say there was a wave of Latin music in the 60s. It came after, I would say after Santana.
There was a time in New York when the Latin jazz was popular. That time of Mongo Santa Maria,
right,
and La Lupe, you know, things like that. You know, but it was a Latin jazz oriented. It wasn't that typical Latin music. It was like a combination of jazz with Latin music. And as far as our community here in Miami, I remember like when we were here. We try to be into the American music, just to be, you know, just not to feel like we're foreigners, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing was like, if I'm going out with a girl, you know, I like to go to an American club, you know, and maybe go out with an American girl, you know. Like we try to join into the community. That was for a few years that we tried to do that. You know, all the kids will like go to the American dances. They wouldn't go to a Cuban club or a Latin club. But then little by little, you know, they were like getting back to their own roots, you know, and saying, hey, you know, why not? You can't get away from the music that you have inside. So little by little, they started going into that. And we started, that was one of the success of the Judge's Nephews. The Judge's Nephews, my group, mixed both cultures. We would play a song in English with a Latin beat, or we would play a song in Spanish with a rock beat, and you know, things like that. That the kids were like, hey, this is okay, you know, this is giving me both things. That's when a lot of groups started doing that. And that's basically the popular groups in Miami, that's what they do now. Chirino, you know, Judge's Nephews. Friends, clouds, they're based on that type of music.
Mm-hmm. What about the Salsa Express?
Salsa Express is a young version of the Cuban music, typical Cuban music. They don't go into English at all, at least not yet. They have stayed into the typical Latin music.
Well, Doris will ask you more specific things about music, but... I wanted to ask you, why do they call this whole area Little Havana?
They call it, it's a nickname because everything has concentrated on this area between this street, 7th Street and 8th Street on the southwest. 7th Street and 8th Street on southwest are the main arteries here for the Latin community, the businesses, you know, and everything. And everything is Latin, so it's like when you go to an area where, you know, everything is there, you know, everything is all,
it's like Chinatown,
it's like Chinatown, you know, or what other, in New York we have what, Germantown, on the east side somewhere,
mm-hmm.
It's like all the German
concentrations,
you know, everybody the people from other countries like to concentrate in one area and have everything there. So that's Little Havana to us.
It's like a Cuban concentration of the business.
Yeah.
Why do you think people tend to do that? This is going to come out on the tape. Let's just wait a minute.
Tampa's the same way.
Tampa has well, as you're saying, in Ybor City, that was an older generation, but I wonder why coming over here, in the 60s, Miami became a Mecca. Everybody came to Miami. Yeah.
Okay. Could you repeat that again, please?
As you said, in, when the already there was an established Cuban community in Tampa, but for some reason in the 60s and whatever, I guess New York and Miami became kind of meccas to settle in this particular place. I wonder why. Do you have any idea?
I don't know why, since we had Cubans in Tampa, why the Cubans didn't say, hey, let's go over there, you know, and well, form mm-hmm. Little Havana in Tampa. Yeah. I don't know why. Uh-huh. Maybe, because Miami was closer.
Yeah. That was it. And Key West was right there. Key West was only 90 miles, and they would leave, they would go back and forth from Key West.
Uh-huh.
No? Mm-hmm. Where was the ferry? Where did that leave, from Tampa or Key West?
No, from Key West.
Ferry boat.
It was a ferry boat that went to Havana and back to Key West.
To the clubs, to the gambling establishments
right,
in
yeah.
Havana, yeah.
Yeah, it was closer.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cubans started establishing here in Miami, and I guess because it was the closest, it was in a small city like Key West, there was no chance to grow, you know, in Key West, so Miami was the closest.
Uh-huh.
And the first years was like waiting for the moment to go back, you know. there was a period of time here that people, the Cuban community, wouldn't they wouldn't get into heavy debts or business or, like, let's say, buy a home or things like that, because they figured, oh, this is just going to take a year. You know, why buy things? Well, you know, I'm going back. You know, I'm not going to stay. And little by little, they started, hey, this is taking long. You know, we better start, you know, we better start doing, forgetting about that and doing something here for our future. Mm-hmm. That's when
yeah.
we started really developing. Enlarging the everything.
Well, we're particularly interested in the things that people feel were important to keep alive. Their parts of their Cuban culture that were important to preserve and not let go by, you know, let them die. And for instance, are there any celebrations that are particularly Latin or Cuban that you celebrate here that maybe we wouldn't have had before you came?
Well, we celebrate, for example, we celebrate on January the 6th, we celebrate the Three Kings Parade, which is, we didn't get gifts on Christmas Day in Cuba. We got the gifts on the 6th of January. Supposedly that's when the Three Kings show up and release it. You know, the same thing that happens here in Christmas, 25th of December, we used to get it on January 6th. So now we still celebrate here with a big parade on 8th Street, you know, and even though the kids get their gifts on the 25th, you know, they don't get them on the 6th. But that parade sort of like reminds you that, you know, we go for the 6th of January as our standard gift given day. What else do we celebrate the 15th birthdays, which is a very popular thing here.
What is that?
It's like a sweet 15 party.
Uh-huh.
But there's people that have money, they spend, you know, they can spend easily $50,000 on a party for the daughter that is just going 15. And then they have, it's like a big production, choreographed with the music, special music for it, you know, big, huge party with dinner and everything. Just, she's like coming into society. She's like coming into, what do you call it?
Society.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Mm-hmm. And these are... These are pretty common here in Miami.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We call them the 15th parties. They're very, very popular. Not everybody can do them, you know, because it's a kind of a status
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When the family is well off, you know, the girl's going to be 15th. The girl wants, you know, dad. And it's like a big wedding, you know. It's like she wears the big gowns and the whole... She gets like five or six, I don't know how many
girls with the boys, you know, tuxedos and everything, and they rehearsed a big dance, and they put on, it's a whole show what they put on.
Do you think that it's probably more than an economic thing? Do you think this is something that reminds them also that they are Cuban? Mm-hmm. And it's something to be proud of, that...
I think so. I think it could have something to do with that. Like, because when you have a party like that, even these girls that are 15 now, they probably speak English, I mean, more than Spanish. They probably speak English all the time. But still, you know, whether it's the parents that say, no, you got to have a party, you got to have a 15th party because you're Cuban, and or the girl says, yeah, you know, I want it. But they do it. You know, they do it. They spend the money and they have those parties.
Yeah.
And we sell them the bands. And
what about New Year's Eve?
New Year's Eve, as far as the Cubans is concerned, is they like to go out. We like to go out to big dances. Yeah. I don't hear of American big gatherings like that on New Year's Eve.
No, I just say everybody celebrates in general. Everybody just goes all out.
Yeah.
You know, whether Cuban, whether Latin, whether whatever. I think everybody just celebrates. That's a general celebration day for everybody.
Yeah, I think so.
What happens that I think there's something that you do that nobody else does, though, with grapes?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
What is it? Tell me about it.
You want to tell me what?
You go ahead and tell me.
Supposedly in Cuba you get 12 grapes, you know, and as the time at 12 o'clock, you know, which with every gong of the bells, supposedly in Cuba, you know, we had the churches and the big bells, you know, gong, then you eat one grape, and then one with each bell, and that was, you know, good luck or something like that.
Uh-huh. And they still do it?
No, I don't think so.
No, not with the bells.
You get the grapes. Yeah. It's a cost. You know, when you pay, let's say you go into a club and you get the party favors, you know, all the hats and stuff like that, and you get a bunch of grapes, probably 12. But people don't just go gang, you know, 12 times. You know, they just...
They've lost part of that then.
Yeah.
There's no churches bringing.
Yeah.
And,
I didn't know that about the church. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about the bells.
Mm-hmm. You didn't know about the bells?
I just saw they eat the grapes. Good luck.
Oh, no.
I don't remember. I don't remember the New Year's Eve parties in Cuba. But I don't think I don't think we sang... the songs that we sing, like, da, 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 da. I don't think we did that in Cuba. I don't know what we did or what my parents did. I think they just say Happy New Year or something. I don't know.
Well, there are other things that are probably very important to pass on to your children, your grandchildren. What kinds of things do you think it's going to be important to tell them about their Cuban heritage?
I'm kind of lost in that question right now.
Mm. Would there be, for instance, lullabies that your mother sang to you that you'd like, you know, like your wife to sing to the children, that would be Spanish lullabies that we wouldn't have here, or food?
The food is important. I have made, I'm thinking of my own children and the things that I have made a point to pass on to them, and it's, one of them is food. They like the Cuban food, you know, and they look for it, and they're not... they know when they, when you say you want to have this, and they say yeah or not, but they know what you're talking about. You know, it's not like a, they're not like completely lost. You know, when you talk about Cuban food, and the language, also something that I'd like to pass on to them.
even though it's hard. My wife is American, mm-hmm. so my kids speak English all the time. So either when they stay with my mother is when they get a chance to, they're forced to speak in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And they kind of, you know, mm-hmm. fake it a little bit. It's not fluent, mm-hmm. you know, Spanish.
What about the music?
The music, too. The food, the music, some of the customs, like they know about the Three Kings, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to like to talk to them about Cuba or the old, you know, my hometown or Spanish.
What about the music?
The music, too. The food, the music, some of the customs, like they know about the Three Kings, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to like to talk to them about Cuba or the old, you know, my hometown, or even though they're interested, you know, to hear things, stories. But I don't know, that they're so into America, they're so Americanized that I'm afraid to be boring, you know, if I start talking to them about my hometown or things like that. Maybe I should wait a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think when they are older, they would appreciate it more than now that they're kids. You know, if I start telling them a story, they just get bored and they just want to go out and play something, do something else.
But when they become adults, that's when they'll probably go.
Yeah.
Boy, I never asked Dad about that.
Right, right.
Yeah. What about you, Carlos? What do you think is important?
I think those same points that he mentioned. Definitely the food, the language, and I would say the music. I think the music is something that...
Oh, yes, definitely.
I do that. I like to keep it.
Right, yeah. Now, you were saying, what do you think is important to pass on?
I think those three things, the food, the language, and I would have to say the music. But I was saying about the music, that's something that you carry in you. When I came to this country, I was very young, but my parents here, they played the music. I wasn't into the music. I was into, in 1964, I was into the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And I wasn't into the Latin music, but at home, when I was hanging around the house, my parents would play typical Latin music from Cuba. So it was there, and it was being programmed into my brain or into me. I don't, you know, people say you carry it in your blood. I think the only thing you carry in your blood is cells and white cells, and this is the only thing you carry in your blood. It's the programming of your mind.
Right.
So, right?
Yeah.
So I was programmed, and like, possibly for a child that is programmed all in one type of music, you'd say they might not carry that. Well, in this particular case, I was programmed to that. And when I met Carlos, I was dealing and booking into rock and English-type lyric-orientated bands. And when I started going into the Latin places and I heard the congas, that's my favorite instrument. And I couldn't stay away from it, but I think it's in the programming of the music anyway.
Mm-hmm. And your parents are musicians themselves?
No, my parents like to sing, and they sing all the time around the house.
Yeah.
But they're not musicians. Yeah.
But that's great though. They sing some of the typical Cuban music.
Yeah, they sing along.
We talked yesterday to the drummer. Interviewed the drummer of Magnum. Mm. And he is
Tico.
Haitian, yeah, Tico, mm-hmm. And he said the same thing about in the blood, and he felt that an Anglo or somebody that didn't relate to that culture could not play the beat, couldn't do it honestly, as he, it just pours out of him. Mm-hmm. It's an expression.
Yeah.
And you're basically saying the same thing.
Well, see, I thought about it when I started singing. I was going to say that you carry that in you, but you really don't. It's a programming in your mind.
It's like the language. It's like the language. You take a Chinese boy from Saigon and bring him to the United States, you know, when he's 3 months old, that boy is not going to have any Chinese costume. He's not going to understand the language. He's going to be an American boy. He's going to go for rock and roll just like anybody else. He's not
bring him back to China, he's going to be there just like an American tourist, you know. The hell is this? Yeah.
But if he comes over when he's 18,
then he's
carries
got
the seeds.
He's got input, 18 years of Chinese input in his brain, in his mind that has been programmed into. We're into a program also that it's called Silva Mind Control. That's what we believe in, that programming of the mind.
Uh-huh.
You program yourself to whatever you whatever you want to be.
Right.
You can do it, you know. And sometimes we get programmed uh-huh. by our parents.
Right. Do you think it's important for most of the Cuban people who live here to keep alive these things that you've been talking about, to remember and really pass on the Cuban culture?
I think so. I think it's important. I think we should try, we should make it a point to keep those things, you know, as far as of our heritage.
I think there's one customer or whatever it is that has kind of being lost here in the United States. And when I was younger and I started dating girls, I found out that one of the customs for my people was that I had to go out with a girl's mother or a chaperone.
Right.
I think that's kind of dissolving here.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I don't know if... Well, at this point in my life, and then in my life when I was younger, it would really bother me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that would bother me so much now.
Yeah.
It all depends on, you know, what you have in mind. You know?
Yeah. You said it.
that's kind of an old-fashioned,
yeah.
you know, way
mm-hmm.
that probably gets, you know, dissolved with the time
yeah,
as women are more independent
mm-hmm.
nowadays, you know, and you don't you don't have to be... Like in Cuba, you know, if you were going to marry a girl, the girl was supposed to be a virgin
right.
before you married her. Otherwise, it was like it wasn't cool, you know, you're marrying a girl that is not a virgin or she's been around, you know, things like that. Not in the United States. In the United States, you know, you can marry a divorced woman with two kids, you know, and it's fine as long as... I mean, there's more freedom here. There's more independence as far as...
Is that the Catholic influence?
Probably, you know. There was a false religion, you know, ruling, you know, everything, society, and it was hard to leave,
mm-hmm.
you know, there with all those rules and things. There's more freedom here, you know, as far as those
right.
conditions.
Right. Doris. Do you want to ask some
sure.
music questions?
I switch this. Yeah, I'm interested in the asking a little bit about the music scene here in Miami. For example, are most of the bands that you work with salsa bands?
I would say 50%. 50% of them are salsa bands, like Salsa Express.
Or at least in their repertoire includes 50% salsa music.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
With the other 50% top 40 off the top 40 charts, English charts.
Mm-hmm.
How many salsa bands are there in Miami?
We're counting off.
You want a list? We have a list there.
We have,
sure, I'd love it.
Well, we could say a good 12.
There's also solo music.
I would say about 12 salsa bands.
Mm-hmm.
There's bands like Salsa Express, you know, 11 people, 12 people.
Is that a typical number of people for a salsa
yeah,
band?
Yeah. They use a lot of brass, percussionists. You know, there's about 3 or 4 percussionists, usually 2 or 3 singers, and one plays the güiro, the other one plays the maracas. You know, it's like it's a very large type of band. You know.
Are most of the what's the sort of the ethnic composition of the bands usually, like the different what background do the different people have who play some of the different instruments?
Oh, Well, the rhythm section, which is, you know, piano bass and percussion, they should be Latin. You know, I mean, if you put somebody, like, if you're gonna play salsa, you have to have somebody that, you know, from Cuba or Puerto Rico, or, you know, playing percussion.
Somebody who's been programmed with that type of beat or feel. It's the feel.
Yeah. As far as the horn section, for example, South Express is a good example of that. The horn section could be Americans, you know, or any other nationality that feel for that, that like that music and get into it, but not necessarily have to be Latin. And they can play. They can play the brass fills and all that with that feeling, you know.
What about singing?
The singing, they have to be Spanish. Yeah. Basically, the whole band, you know, I think I would say...
Have to be Latin.
Has to be Latin. The brass section is the one that you can accommodate somebody from the, you know, an American person, and it wouldn't...
The brass arrangements are very jazzy. They're jazz-orientated. Even the piano, I would say the chords, a lot of the progressions are jazzy. So the Latin, the salsa music, I would say, has a very... It's very heavily influenced by jazz. With Afro, with the rhythm, with the Afro rhythm.
Which parts are written out usually, and which parts are the musicians just supposed to be able to improvise or know without having it in front of them?
Okay, the brass, you know, is written, so as part of the arrangement, you know, on the piano is written. The all the percussion and you know, goes, since it's the same thing repeating, they just rehearse the songs and they know when they're gonna cut and, you know, change from here to there, but it's all more feel than reading. But the brass has to read, and the piano player and the bass player, they have to follow, you know, a certain part of the pattern.
One thing, how did salsa music get started? Where does it come from?
Salsa is, that's the
that's a very good question.
The question of the salsa. Cuba had a lot of different types of music. You know, we had guaracha, cha-cha-cha, guaguancó. It's like here you can say we have heavy rock, or you have mellow rock, or you have rhythm and blues, or, you know, funk, and, you know, all kinds of things. And then they all fall into what?
Nothing.
Into rock and roll. Let's say, or into American music. When you say American music, you're referring to rock or funk or something, but you know that it's not Latin. So we had all this type of music, mambo, guaracha, you know. And in the United States, to give it a one name, to cover everything under one name, was called salsa. And started in New York, you know, when they started recording, and we started getting a lot of Latin American influence coming out of New York, and then they decided to call it salsa to everything.
When was that? When did it start in New York?
When did salsa start? 1960, there wasn't salsa yet. So I would say like 65.
Say more than that. I would say around 70. Around
there. On the 70s?
Yeah.
Probably. On the 70s, that's when we started hearing the word salsa. Yeah.
Was that word used ever in Cuba before that?
No. I mean, the word was used. Salsa means sauce, you know, like
tomato
gravy
sauce.
A sauce, you know, all with all the ingredients, you know, the thing that adds the flavor to your meat or whatever you're cooking. So they decided, you know, to call it. The word salsa was when you say, like, somebody has salsa or sabor, means that it's somebody that is really, you know, peppy, somebody that's really with it, happy person or something like that. And then, but that word was used to baptize the whole spectrum of Latin music, each different rhythms that would come up. Mm-hmm. And there was one time that people would love to come up with a new dance or a new rhythm. Not anymore, but there was a time that, like cha-cha-cha, and then from cha-cha-cha, somebody would say, okay, I'm gonna mix bolero with cha-cha-cha, and we'll call it bolero cha. So then, like trying to establish that as a new dance.
That's me.
But that faded out. It was getting too complicated. There were too many different fields, you know.
That happened here.
So salsa covered everything else.
That happened here also about 4 years ago. Same thing happened here when the disco came out, the hustle came out, the Latin hustle. Yeah. Then it was just recently it was the freak and the rock. And different types of dances, but then it
all got involved into dance-oriented music.
Right. Yeah.
So salsa is mainly dance music.
Yes, salsa is dance music.
It's commercial too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than traditional.
Mm-hmm. Are there any musicians here in Miami that still play some of these other styles like huaracha or guaguancó?
Well, that's what salsa is. That's what salsa is.
They just don't call it. They don't refer to it by that, those titles.
You can turn the radio on now and hear a song, and I can tell you that's a guaracha, or that's a guaguancó, or that's a mambo, but it's not called that. It's called salsa. So,
what's a typical song, say the title of a song, that you would call, say, a guaguancó song?
I can't think of one now. This one that starts like a guaguancó.
Beto's new song starts like a guaguancó.
What was it called? Para mí o para ti?
Que pasa something.
Yeah. Que pasa. Is it on the chart?
Yes, sir.
I'll tell you in a minute. I got a chart.
That starts like...
Dime que te pasa.
Right.
See, it starts as a guaguancó, and then it goes into like a plena or a bomba, which is a Puerto Rican rhythm. And but that's called salsa.
What's the distinguishing, you know, feature that you can tell that it's a guaguancó?
The rhythm.
Yeah, it's the rhythm.
The patterns that the percussion uses, the congas,
it's like
and the
bongos. 6/8 beat. It's a 6/8 time. Is that what it is? That's what it is, isn't it?
Like the guaguancó has that. The congas go like dum, 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 and that gives you a feel of a guaguancó, and then you say, hey, you know, that's a guaguancó. Mm-hmm. Hey, I know a guaguancó when I hear one.
Do you have another one of those?
Yeah, sure.
Chart? Yeah.
That's what about guaracha?
Guaracha is more
the rhythm for that.
I don't know the words to describe it. It's more straight, it's more, it's got the intro, and the, you know, the song is more...
Structure.
Yeah, the structure of the song is not, doesn't go into any of this other, you know, beats. Mm-hmm. It's a regular beat, let's say. Mm-hmm. And the tempo also gives you what it is, you know, the speed.
Is the conga drum really important in determining which kind of music it is?
Very, yes, very. The conga and the instrumentation. Also, for example, there's another thing called charanga. Charanga is still salsa, but it's a different style of salsa. It's called charanga because the instrumentation is violins and a flute. There's no brass. There's no brass in this type of band. So you just have three violins, like charanga modelo, for example. I have a picture back there. It's got three violins, a flute, and a timbal player. But this timbal player plays with thin sticks, and it's like a very just like very time-keeping rhythm that he plays, you know.
Very light?
Light, yeah, and the congas, you know. It doesn't have that, like the other salsa bands have, that have maybe two guys playing one big bell like this and driving, you know, it's like a real heavy thing. The charanga is more,
sort of,
it's a quieter.
Sounds like you could describe it with delicate or...
More delicate, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the charanga, it's called charanga now, but it used to be typical music from Cuba. Like the years ago, we started out with a danzón, which was a very kind of like a the danzón had, I would say, like a minuet type of feel as far as the dance. You know, there would be a part in the middle that would be like a band. Section that the band will play, and then the couple will stop dancing, and the lady with the long dress, you know, and everything, like sort of like a French type of thing, she would just you know, cool off, and they would talk, you know, and wait for the next part to start, and then they would start dancing again, very proper and very, you know, that was danzón, was one of our typical dances. And then there was a part in the danzón at the end where the band would go into a break and will start a section that had a little more flavor, was a little, you know, more rhythmically exciting before they went into the end of the thing. To go into the end of the song, they would go back to the, like, to the beginning, and then it would end. But that part, everybody waited for that part. So then when the cha-cha-cha started out, they pick that middle section that everybody waited for in this danzones, they say, okay, this is cha-cha-cha. So cha-cha-cha became a whole song, but using that rhythm. And then that rhythm, that band was consisted of violins and flute, you know. So that's when cha-cha-cha started. It was violins, flute, but on that, you know,
so
faster and more percussion beat.
So what you're saying is that the charanga that we have now is the fusion of that.
Right.
It's mm-hmm. using that slightly more mm-hmm. Dynamic rhythm,
right.
But with the instruments that would have been used for the danzón.
It's right.
Very elegant.
Exactly. It's that typical band. But then, while it was danzón, the time had to be, you know, it was limited. You know, you had to play it at a certain tempo, you know, which was... Then when cha-cha-cha came in, the cha-cha-cha was a little bit faster. There was a little more freedom with the tempo. And now with the charanga, you can play it at any tempo you want. So you can write a song that can go like, you know, like real fast or slow, you know, whatever. There's no tempo limit to it. You know, there's conditioning, you know. It's just whatever the song or the writer wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's called charanga today, which involves cha-chas and all those things.
Do any of the people who are singing in the charanga style, do they do inspiraciones the way the salsa singers do?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
What in English we'd call that improvisation.
Improvisation.
Yeah. How is it the same or different?
Well, the structure of the song is basically the same, except for the instrumentation. But you have your, you know, the chorus of the song, you know, with the message, the lyrics, you know, verses and everything. And then there's a point that there's a break, and then the coro comes in. And that's the thing that repeats and repeats. And between that, you improvise, or the flute does a solo. And this type of music, charanga, the flute always has a solo. The flute is the like the lead instrument of the band. And
but you would you still have a singer singing the way Alberto Santiago
mm-hmm.
did this kind of answering back and forth, singing with the chorus? Does that happen in charanga?
With the charanga, yes, it happens. I think it happens with all the Latin music. It's a
call and response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
expression.
I was just wondering if it, before I forget it, we were wanting to get a record album of the Salsa Express and maybe Chirango Modelo, if you...
Okay, I should have... I think I promised you that, and I don't know if I have...
Well, if...
I'll check here.
Okay, if not...
We'd like to put them up in the archive because we're
perhaps use bits and pieces from the album itself on the radio show, interspersed with live performance kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that maybe are are pointed out in our interview that you could just from the album pick those things out and say as you say this, then it goes right into that so that people it would. Click in their minds. Like
right.
when you said, well, the flute always has a solo, just take a little cut of a flute solo from Chirango.
Yeah, yeah.
Modelo.
I don't know. Yeah, I have Típica Pata. Yes, that's a Chirango band.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
thank
so
you so much. You can turn on the air conditioner. Yay, I know it's getting hotter and hotter.
Let me find you.
Yeah.